I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times.
Among those freedoms is the right to worship according to our own beliefs. That is why I will get rid of and totally destroy the Johnson Amendment and allow our representatives of faith to speak freely and without fear of retribution. I will do that. Remember.
That was President Trump speaking at the National Prayer Breakfast last week about religious freedom. And while the Johnson Amendment might be news to you, its repeal is something candidate Trump promised to evangelicals and religious conservatives. In fact, it was part of his acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention this past summer. In a nutshell, the law says that a tax-exempt nonprofits cannot endorse or oppose political candidates. The amendment became law back in 1954 when it was pushed by then-Senator Lyndon Johnson, who was in a tight race for re-election. Emma Green covers religion and politics for The Atlantic. We asked her to join us on Radio Times for a short history lesson on the Johnson Amendment and the implications if it is repealed. And Emma Green, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
So why did then-Senator Lyndon Johnson author this law? Of course, this is back in the 1950s.
Yes, this is a long-standing tax provision, and it's often credited to Lyndon Johnson's skill as a legislator that he was able to get this through. This was a back-and-forth back in the 1950s to try to clarify earlier provisions, either through legislatures or court decisions, around what degree nonprofit organizations could actually write off their donations to religious candidates or contribute some of their funds to political activities. The 1954 amendment was an attempt to actually clarify and codify within the tax code a standard around these kinds of donations.
Well, let me quote a little bit from this law that churches and other nonprofit organizations exempt from taxation, quote, are absolutely prohibited from directly or indirectly participating in or intervening in any political campaign on behalf of or in opposition to any candidate for elective public office. Has this law been carried out as intended?
On the one hand, there have been some cases of enforcement. There was a full-page ad, for example, that was taken out, I believe, during the 90s, which basically explicitly from a church organization was an attack on Bill Clinton. The IRS has pursued cases that are really explicit like that. But for the most part, the IRS hasn't really made this one of its enforcement priorities, and particularly in the last couple of decades, this hasn't been a huge part of the landscape of what churches face or religious organizations face as potential consequences for political activities or statements.
And I seem to remember religious people talking about Donald Trump candidate Hillary Clinton as well.
Absolutely. You know, religion and politics have always been tied in the United States from its very earliest history, and I think this past election cycle was no exemption to that. I think, for example, you would go to churches. I went many times for reporting, and I would hear pastors offer sermons that weren't explicitly about Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, maybe didn't name check them, right, but were very, very obviously about politics.
There are things, though, it seems that, and the focus is largely on these religious institutions, but it should be said that I think most of this tax exemption is really for nonprofits. But there are things, apparently, religious institutions can do. They can do voter registration. They can do other things as well. Can you flesh that out for us, Emma?
Sure. So as you mentioned, voter registration drives and particularly candidate forums are hallmarks of the political process during the campaign season. Churches and religious organizations often get involved in particular issue advocacy as well, advocating on behalf of the poor, trying to create programs that support social justice initiatives, that sort of thing. Or on the other side, advocating for certain types of social and moral provisions, like advocating against same-sex marriage or being part of the pro-life movement and protesting abortion. What is prohibited, though, is specifically getting involved in politicking activities, endorsing or opposing candidates from the pulpit, making donations to particular kinds of campaigns, essentially acting as political agents within a campaigning system.
And there have been these Pulpit Freedom Sundays. This is really a protest against the Johnson Amendment. Who's behind this and what have been the results?
This has been a movement going on since 2008, and it is largely led by conservative Protestant churches that have basically said, we're not going to abide by the tax code provision. They will take one Sunday a year, or sometimes even more, and explicitly make statements about politics. And they actually have actively antagonized the IRS about this, sending videos of themselves making these statements to the IRS as sort of a dare to enforce the Johnson Amendment against them. But the IRS hasn't really taken the bait. It's not one of the priorities that it's really pursued, even in regards to sort of blatant and purposeful violation of the tax provision.
So why did candidate Trump and now President Trump, why has he made this such an important issue?
This is an issue that might be surprising to a lot of Americans because it hasn't gotten a ton of play in past cycles. But my understanding is that prominent evangelical leaders whispered in Trump's ear or asked him explicitly to make this one of his big issues. I think at a time, especially in the late spring and summer, when Trump was trying to create a real coalition of support from some of those more social conservatives who had perhaps supported candidates like Ted Cruz in the Republican primary, he was really trying to court them. And the Johnson Amendment was one of the main planks of his promise to religious conservatives about what he would do in office.
And what would it take to undo the Johnson Amendment? Can the president undo it with the stroke of a pen, for instance?
No, this is certainly something that will require involvement from Congress. And even more broadly than that, the way that this is executed is going to be very complicated if Trump is actually serious and the Republican legislature is actually serious about carrying it out. The first question would be how extensive the change is. Would this apply to all nonprofits? Would it be something where groups who are currently under 501c4 who can do lobbying would all become 501c3s? And then the question is whether a specific exemption for religious organizations under that 501c3 status would create legal challenges, creating a preference for religious groups over and above other types of nonprofits.
How about the idea of losing your tax exemption? And it seems that part of this is that if you're going to get a tax exemption, your free speech is a little more limited than other people. Is there an effort to say, okay, pay your taxes and then you can talk as you please?
Certainly, I think that would be an argument from the side of anti-sectarian or, you know, sort of pro-church and state separation legal advocates. They would say, sure, churches, do whatever you want, but you shouldn't be subsidized by the government for participating in political activities. I think churches and other organizations would argue that 501c3 status is essential for their functioning. They can't survive based on their low budgets if they want to continue doing the type of ministry activity that's so important to them. But they also believe that political speech is important to them and that kind of freedom should be afforded to them by the Constitution. So there are arguments on both sides.
Do you think Congress has an appetite to pick this up? There's a lot coming in from the White House that they're dealing with every single day. Do you think there's an appetite for this?
It's a great question, and I'm not sure I know the answer. Trump has by far been the most vocal politician on this issue, especially during the campaign season. And I do think there are Republican members of Congress who have an appetite for this type of religious freedom legislation, or what's framed as religious freedom legislation. However, the Johnson Amendment and the repeal of the Johnson Amendment would be extraordinarily complicated. It would almost certainly lead to years of legal battles in its wake, and there would just be a lot of administrative issues that Congress have to attend to if it does want to fundamentally change what 501c3 organizations can do. It's unclear amid all of the other priorities, whether it's the budget, immigration, or even other religious liberty issues, whether this one will rise to the top of what Congress wants to do.
You describe this, you call this religious nationalism. What do you mean by that?
So along with Trump's other comments from the National Prayer Breakfast, he seems to be presenting a vision of religious nationalism for the United States, this idea that American identity, American values and freedoms are all tightly bound up in America's identity as a putatively Christian nation. And the repeal of the Johnson Amendment is very much in lockstep with that. It's this idea that churches and religious organizations should ultimately have the highest level of freedom to be able to be involved in our politics. And in fact, those organizations have an invaluable voice when sort of contributing to the political discussion.
Do you see this ban that was instituted, this temporary ban, do you see this as part of this religious nationalism?
I do think that the executive order on refugees and immigration is part of this notion of religious nationalism. And we saw this again in Trump's comments at the National Prayer Breakfast. He presented a very, very dark view of the enemies of America overseas and largely talked about them in religious and ideological terms. It's extremist Islam. It's radical Islamic ideology. Those are the types of terms that he highlighted over and over again. And that was the justification and the grounds for this executive order. I think putting the United States and setting it up in opposition to those kinds of dark ideological forces is very much a sign of Trump's religious nationalist vision.
You also say that if Congress upends the Johnson Amendment, it would give churches, I guess, and other nonprofits that have tax exemption, the kind of power that a super PAC has. Explain what that means.
So the other consequence of the Johnson Amendment, which isn't necessarily talked about all the time, is that it limits the amount of money that can be flowing from churches or nonprofit organizations into politics. There have been sort of loose standards over time set up largely by court decisions about what an appropriate amount of money from a church coffer or a nonprofit bank account is to go into politics, and that's somewhere between 5 and 20% of the operating budget. But if the Johnson Amendment were repealed, either for religious organizations or all nonprofits, that would potentially totally obliterate the financial limits that have previously been in place on what kind of money those organizations can contribute to politics. So this means that churches and other nonprofit groups could essentially become like lobbying firms. And the United States government, by giving them tax-exempt status, would be subsidizing that activity.
Do we know how people who attend church or mosques or synagogues, do we know how they feel about the Johnson Amendment or the idea of their pastor, their imam, their priest, their rabbi getting more politically involved?
So there are a handful of churches and, as I said, largely conservative Protestant organizations who have really taken this on as their cause celebre. They believe that it's a big free speech issue. I think pastors would say that that's the case, and their parishioners would probably agree. I think for the most part, people in the United States who go to worship services at a synagogue or a mosque or at a church probably don't know that much about what the Johnson Amendment is, and they probably feel pretty comfortable with this dividing line between their church and their synagogue and their mosque being a religious body versus being a political body. But I do know that this sort of runs the gamut on all sides of the political spectrum. There are religious organizations that are more interested in being involved in politics and others that don't really care and don't see that as part of their. So I think you would really probably see differing opinions on both sides of the aisle.
We're almost out of time here, but do you see a big fight looking ahead on this issue?
Certainly, if Trump makes good on his promise and pushes this to the fore of his agenda coming out of the White House and is able to get Republican legislators in Congress on board, there is going to be a big fight over what the consequences of this will be, what the structure of it would be, and ultimately how constitutional it is and what the shape of the legal battles in its wake would be.
Well, Emma Green, thanks for laying out the issues. I'm sure we'll be returning to this issue. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. That's Emma Green. She covers religion and politics for The Atlantic. And we have another guest waiting in the wings, Charlie Giroux, talking about Pennsylvania politics and the Republican Party and President Trump. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton in Pennsylvania, one of the battleground states that put him over the top on election night. He had strong support in many of the rural parts of the Commonwealth. Well, it's been a tumultuous time since the inauguration, both inside and outside the White House. We want to check in with Charlie Giroux for his take on Trump's first few weeks in office. He's someone we talk to about Republican politics and Pennsylvania. He's a Republican consultant, CEO of Quantum Communications at PR. An issue advocacy firm in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And Charlie, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you, Marty, and a boy that grew up in Philadelphia, PA.
So. Well, we like all of that. Let me give that phone number, and it's 1-888-477-9499. To join our conversation, you can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Charlie, it's week three of the Trump administration. If you could give President Trump one piece of advice at the beginning of this week, what would you tell him?
Well, to keep on course, but to make sure that you have your I's dotted and your T's crossed before you go public. I think that's been the, you know, the one weakness of the Trump administration thus far is that they've moved a little too quickly on a couple of things and haven't been as careful as they should have been. The refugee thing in particular, the quote-unquote immigration ban, was, you know, frankly quite clumsily handled. But, you know, this is a brand-new administration with brand-new folks, and very few administrations do this much in the first 2 weeks.
Well, in fact, I was looking at a couple of surveys, some of the public feeling that the president is doing too much in those first 2 weeks. Do you think that's an issue, and do you think that has created some of the problems coming out of the White House?
No, I think that his supporters wanted these things done, wanted them done quickly. It's what he ran on. It's what he promised to do. And much of what he's done thus far, Marty, has been to, with his executive pen, undo the things that Barack Obama did with his. I don't like that on either side of the aisle. I think that the tripartite system of government that our founders put together is the way things should work through the Congress of the United States. So I'm hoping that President Trump is near the end of using the executive action and executive order pen and will go back to what we call regular order of working with the Congress in order to get things done. I believe he will, but he had to undo what Barack Obama had done and running Congress consistently.
Talking about this temporary ban that was implemented or attempts to implement it, and the more we're learning about it, apparently it came out of a small group out of the White House with a little bit of, seems like almost like secret negotiations or contact with some of people who work in Congress. He did not apparently touch base with some of the people whose job it is to carry out this order. And frankly, when you hear some of the stories about, for instance, translators for U.S. troops who were denied entrance into the U.S., these are really people that did what we have asked them to do, going through the legal process in order to be able to live in this country. How much damage do you think he has done?
You know, it's interesting, Marty. The left would like us to believe that there's been great damage done and that his rhetoric has been this and that. They didn't seem to complain that much when virtually the same identical rhetoric was used by Bill Clinton 20 years ago when he did pretty much the same thing. Refugee status is almost the exclusive purview of the President of the United States. That's not something that ordinarily requires congressional approval or congressional action. So to have not consulted with or dealt with the Congress as much as folks would have liked on that is more a matter of courtesy than a matter of constitutional or legal constraint. So I think there's a big difference there. As I say, you know, I don't think that the entire issue was handled in terms of its execution as smoothly as it could have been. I think that's pretty obvious, and execution matters. But underlying it all, I think people need to have the facts of what has actually occurred.
He said 109 people were inconvenienced. The State Department says it's closer to 60,000. How do we reconcile those two numbers?
I don't know. You'll have to tell me. I don't know.
Fair enough. The judge that has essentially, at least for the time being, stayed this executive order, he called him a so-called judge. He tweeted out a couple of other, frankly, uncomplimentary things about the judge, basically saying if something bad happens, it's his fault. How much do you think President Trump really understands the balance of power in Washington, D.C.?
Well, I think he does understand the balance of power, and I think he understands that one federal judge sitting in Seattle doesn't get to call this for the entire nation, and that's obviously going to be litigated. It's already into the Circuit Court of Appeals, the most liberal Circuit Court of Appeals in the country, so we'll see what they do. But ultimately, that issue is headed to the Supreme Court. I don't think there's much of a question about that, and then we will see what the courts do in balancing out the power of the executive. That's not anything unique to the Trump administration. That's something that's been going on since the beginning of the republic.
But do we have presidents talking about so-called called judges. He, as we know, as a candidate, he went after Judge Curiel with the Trump University controversy. It just doesn't seem particularly presidential.
Well, I would have to sort of agree with you on that, Marty, but he didn't call me and ask for my advice on that, so I didn't get to offer it. I wouldn't do it if I were the president, but guess what? My name wasn't on the ballot, neither was yours. People voted for Donald Trump. He is the president. He gets to play it his way, and he has already shown that he is not going to be a conventional, by-the-book chief executive at all. So anybody that's looking for that, you know, better look again.
Well, I had said in my intro that it was voters in Pennsylvania who voted for Trump that gave him the win back in November. Going back, I guess, a couple of months, the supporters that Trump has in Pennsylvania, what do they want from this administration?
I think they want action, and that's why they're getting precisely what they asked for. They were fed up with the fact that Washington couldn't get things done, that there appeared to be gridlock at every corner, that they had a president who was in Barack Obama, who was end-running Congress and using that executive pen to do things that he had no constitutional authority to do. And as you know, the courts were, you know, pretty consistent in knocking down his executive orders for their overreach, et cetera. And I think that's what the Trump voters in Pennsylvania wanted. They wanted action. They wanted change. Of all the words that could have described the mood of the electorate and why things moved the way that they did on November the 8th, I think change is the most significant word, and behind that action to effectuate that change.
And how do we translate that? I mean, based on what we know about voters in the state, a lot of the supporters for Trump had either lost jobs or lost wages, were concerned about trade deals. Is that change for them as you see it, Charlie?
I think it's coming, yeah. I think that what you've seen already in terms of President Trump opening up jobs through the pipelines that had been stalled by Barack Obama, which he knew were stalls that weren't going to last. They were just holding actions so that we can get energy to our manufacturing sector and to ordinary consumers more cheaply, inexpensively, and safely. I mean, that's the thing that, you know, kind of makes me chuckle, is that the opposition to pipelines would have us bringing this energy to us on rail trains. They used to call them bomb trains because they were infinitely more dangerous than pipelines. So I think that President Trump is already doing things that are good for jobs, good for the economy, et cetera. And let me say this, Marty. You know, there were an awful lot of folks that you described correctly, many of them Democrats, by the way, who voted for Donald Trump in the quote-unquote more rural sections of Pennsylvania.
Right.
But in the urban centers, most notably in Philadelphia, Hillary Clinton's people didn't turn up to vote. They did not support her. They didn't support the third term of Barack Obama. The numbers for Barack Obama in the city of Philadelphia in both 2008 and 2012 made Hillary Clinton's vote pale by comparison.
And it's clear that there were certainly those inner ring, or what they call ring suburbs around Philadelphia. There was pretty much split between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, as I understand it, as I remember just a couple of months ago.
No, that is correct. And, you know, in Bucks County, for example, where Barack Obama had done exceptionally well and where the Hillary Clinton people were telling folks they were going to win by more than 10,000 votes, they won by less than two. Those were the margins that, you know, ultimately delivered the state to Donald Trump as much as the rural Democrats and conservative Republicans in central Pennsylvania.
That is Charlie Giroux, our second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. He's a Republican consultant, CEO of Quantum Communications. That's a PR and issue advocacy firm in Harrisburg. And we do talk with him from time to time to get his perspective on politics and, of course, the busy first couple of weeks of the Trump administration. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, although I see it looks like most of our emails were for the first guest that we had on the show. We're interested in your take on President Trump and the first couple of weeks of his administration. That email address, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. President Trump candidate Trump promised to drain the swamp, but he has, and he certainly criticized Hillary Clinton for being in the pocket of Wall Street, for the speeches that she gave and her associations with these very well-connected law firms or financial firms. But when you look at his cabinet, you've got Goldman Sachs, you've got millionaires, you've got billionaires. Knowing what you know about Trump voters in Pennsylvania, Charlie, are they pleased with the look of his cabinet?
Well, gee, did Barack Obama have anybody from Goldman Sachs in his administration?
No, I believe me, I'm not defending any of that. I'm just saying he made this such a key issue of his campaign, and I'm sure a lot of people that voted for him thought this is a new day. We're going to bring in new and different people into government.
And I think that most Trump voters, at least the ones that I've talked to, Marty, are very, very, very pleased with the selections that President Trump has made for his cabinet, bringing in people like General Mattis at Defense, which is not ordinary, required, as you know, a congressional waiver of the statute that would have precluded him from being Secretary of Defense. Those are the kinds of picks that are not typical, are not ordinary in any way, shape, manner, or form. And I think that some of the controversy that surrounds a couple of his cabinet appointees is particularly and especially because they don't fit the ordinary mold. I think that most of the Trump voters are very, very pleased with the selections that President Trump has made to fill his cabinet.
I do want to play a clip from the interview that President Trump did with Bill O'Reilly. This was yesterday before the Super Bowl, and I know people are kind of on a Super Bowl high or low, perhaps depending on who you were voting for. But let me play just a portion of this clip where Bill O'Reilly is talking to President Trump about Vladimir Putin.
Do you respect Putin?
I do respect him.
Do you? Why?
Well, I respect a lot of people. But that doesn't mean I'm going to get along with him. He's a leader of his country. I say it's better to get along with Russia than not. And if Russia helps us in the fight against ISIS, which is a major fight, and Islamic terrorism all over the world, major fight, that's a good thing. Will I get along with him? I have no idea.
He's a killer, though. Putin's a killer.
A lot of killers. We got a lot of killers. Why, you think our country's so innocent? You think our country's so innocent?
I don't know of any government leaders that are killers in America.
Well, take a look at what we've done, too. We've made a lot of mistakes. I've been against the war in Iraq from the beginning.
Yeah, mistakes are different then.
A lot of mistakes, okay, but a lot of people were killed. So a lot of killers around, believe me.
Charlie, you run a PR firm. How do you deal with that?
That might be above my pay grade, Marty. I mean, this is something that Donald Trump has said before, something he said along the campaign trail. They are not words that I would have used and not words that I think a lot of my colleagues would use. But again, Donald Trump is a president that's going to break the mold on communications on, if not a daily basis, certainly on a weekly basis. And at least thus far, it has worked for him. You know, many times during the course of that campaign last year, he said and did things that would have absolutely sunk the candidacy of anybody else, but it didn't for him. Why that is, I think there are going to be books and volumes written about, but it is a fact of matter. It's more than simply being Teflon-coated, as they used to say about my former boss, Ronald Reagan. I think that it is a acknowledgement of the way information is conveyed these days, about the power of social media and the difference in the way that it filters information. And I think you're seeing a coming of age of a new way of talking and a new way of dealing with communications.
Do you think, though, Charlie, this statements like that, and we're going to do more hours on Putin and Trump, but does that create problems for the Republican Party to say something like that?
I don't know. It potentially creates problems. I will acknowledge that, Marty. And I don't know what all of the fallout is going to be. I mean, I'm sure you can divine my feelings. Pardon me. I just dropped the phone from it. I'm sure you can divine my feelings about Vladimir Putin and the sense that Donald Trump has about him. I don't view him in the same way, and I'm much more cautious in any approach with him. And I do think that he's not a particularly nice guy. But President Trump has the ability to make calls that I don't have. And I'm not sure what all of the fallout of this is going to be. I think it's going to have to be pretty much at this point a wait-and-see situation.
Let me get Charlotte from Doylestown to join our conversation. Charlotte, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The first thing I'd like to say, just listening to this interview, is the first comment that comes to my mind is, sadly, a democracy gets what a democracy deserves. And my question is, earlier in this conversation, you mentioned Donald Trump is different. He's all about change and action. And my question is, how can change for the sake of change and action just to take action be something positive if it's not well thought out, calculated, well advised? which is what I think Donald Trump doesn't do. I don't think he is well thought out, his policies, his decisions. I don't think he really has advisors that have enough experience to advise him correctly. And it gives me great pause and concern, and I'd like to know what you think
sure.
about that.
Fair enough. Charlotte, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Charlie, we touched on this earlier, but go ahead.
Well, I think, again, most of the policies that Donald Trump is enacting are exactly what the American people want and what they voted for in November. If the execution of those policies hasn't been pitch perfect, frankly, it's because you're 2 weeks into an administration that's doing an awful lot, whereas previous administrations would still be trying to figure out their way to the men's room. And that I think, is the principal difference. The caller's notion that we're doing things just for the sake of change is, I think, a little bit misplaced. I think it was the previous administration that did that. And you had Barack Obama, for example, blocking the Keystone pipeline, the Keystone XL pipeline, which most Democrats in Pennsylvania strongly support, and virtually all Republicans do. It's vital to Pennsylvania. It's vital to the job situation here, to the economic growth situation here, to consumers here. And, you know, Barack Obama blocked it with an executive action, and Donald Trump overturned that, thankfully. Those are the kinds of things that not only did people vote for, but which are best for this region and the country as we go down the road.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye to you. So picking up on what you just said, then how would you describe President Trump's political philosophy? Because I think for a lot of people, just trying to figure out how to respond to tweets and if whether, you know, a Twitterverse reflects a political philosophy.
Well, I think, Marty, you've asked the million-dollar question, and the answer is I don't know, and I don't think too many people do. I'm a conservative Republican, as you know.
Right.
I don't think that Donald Trump ultimately is a conservative Republican, at least not in the classic definition of that phrase. My partner, Ed Rollins, whom everybody knows,
sure.
says that we have elected the first independent president. I think there's some truth to that. Donald Trump goes his own way, charts his own course. He ultimately, I think, is more conservative than liberal. But as you know, he was a Democrat for many years of his life. He, you know, took on positions that were, you know, on the left side of the aisle. I think on a lot of environmental issues and certainly on significant number of social issues, he's either left of center or, you know, marginally left of center. So I think to define his political philosophy is going to be a difficult question, one that I can't answer today, and I think is, again, one that we're going to have to see how it actually emerges,
well,
because it hasn't always been that defined.
Stay tuned. Charlie, I always enjoy talking with you. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's my pleasure, Marty. Have a great week, and
you too.
To you and your listeners.
Thanks. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. So does this sound like you? I just can't take the onslaught of news anymore. It makes me angry. It makes me anxious. I'm yelling at my TV. I want to take a break, but I keep getting pulled back into the latest Twitter war or news feud on my news feed. Our guest, Nir Eyal, decided to go on a news diet of sorts. He's a business consultant, wrote a book called Hooked, and he joins us on Radio Times. And Nir Eyal, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. So good to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And to our listeners, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. It seems, and you wrote about this, that we have competing impulses. One is to stay informed, but to also not feel overwhelmed or even anxious and angry about the news that we are ingesting. Is this a recipe for stress?
I think it certainly is, and I think I'm the story here that makes the point. Leading up to the election and since the election and the inauguration, you know, the constant barrage of news items and headlines that are frankly, you know, drawn to make us keep reading them can be something that distracts us from what we really should be doing in our day-to-day lives. And I think that's what I struggled with, and so I kind of wrote this this article and looked at it from a behavioral science lens of how do we put it in its place? How do we make sure that it doesn't get the best of us?
Well, it's interesting, and I do want to get to some of the things that you did, but I want to just sort of set up the psychological environment, I guess, that we're in. And you do write about, and it's clear, news is highly competitive these days, especially when it comes to, let's say, cable TV news. Is the notion of conflict, is that the way of kind of drawing us in and keeping us involved?
Well, the basic premise of what makes news so engaging is what psychologists call a variable reward or a variable a schedule of reinforcement. It comes from the classic work of B.F. Skinner. So the father of operant conditioning, he took these pigeons, he put them in a little box, and he gave them a reward every time they pecked at a little disc. And what he observed was when he gave the reward, when he gave the food pellet on a predictable schedule, meaning the pigeon would peck at the disc and get the food pellet every time, basically the pigeon would peck at the disc whenever they were hungry. But then he did something a little different. He added some variability. So sometimes the pigeon would peck at the disc and nothing would come out. The next time the pigeon would peck at the disc, they would receive the food pellet. And what Skinner observed was the rate of response, the number of times that these pigeons pecked at the disc, increased when the reward was given on a variable schedule of reinforcement. And it's that same variability, the first three letters of news, what's new, what's different, what's changed, that's what keeps us checking and checking and checking.
So we're just little pigeons getting intermittent rewards. Is that how it works?
Well, it's certainly the case with news. It's always been what makes news interesting. Now, what we see lately is this phenomenon of social media, which has really perfected this contraption of a variable reward, almost a slot machine-like mechanic that we see online that keeps us pulling to refresh and pulling to refresh and pulling to refresh in this constant stream of information that we can consume. Now I want to say here just for a second, I don't think this is bad necessarily.
Right.
It's the dosage that makes the poison. I want the news to inform me. I want a free press. I want the access to information. I guess the question that I asked myself a few weeks ago was, when is this serving me and when am I serving it?
So what did you do to deal with the conundrum you were in?
Well, the first thing was to stop. just to be mindful. I mean, the problems happen when we become mindless, right? So, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with a nice glass of wine. We start having problems, however, when we start consuming alcohol without thinking how much we're consuming, and we lose control. And I think that's what I was kind of becoming. I was becoming a news junkie, a news addict, because I was, you know, pulling to refresh and watching every news program and looking at every headline. And when I had to really stop myself for a minute and just think, wait a minute, what's the purpose here? Why am I consuming this news? And do I need to consume this much information, this much news? And the answer was, yes, it's important. I want to stay informed as a good American, as an active citizen. But is this extent really helping me? So that's the first step, is to ask yourself, is the behavior helping me or hurting me? And by the way, this is something we should do with all good things. I think the cost of this miracle of information technology that we so enjoy is that it's so good, it's hard to put down. Just like when you go to a bakery and you see all the amazing desserts that the baker's made for you, you don't say to the baker, hey, stop making this good stuff, it's too delicious. You moderate your behavior and, you know, don't eat so much chocolate cake, have it once in a while. And so that's what I did first.
Well, and you did some interesting things, which is you now read the print version of a newspaper as opposed to reading it online. Of course, when you read it online, it's there are updates and refreshes, and then there's, you know, you can read the comments section and go kind of crazy. But you chose to read just the print version of a newspaper, and I guess just newspapers that you feel like are giving you actual news.
Right. So I have not subscribed to a newspaper, a print newspaper, in probably 15 years. And I thought this was kind of an antiquated technology that I would never go back to, given that it's, you know, all this information is available online for free. But, you know, not every technology that's new is necessarily good all the time. That sometimes you want to evaluate, wait a minute, is the latest and greatest technology actually doing the job better than the last version of technology? And what I found was that by moving to a print edition, it did two really good things for me. One, because I was paying for it, I knew it was going to come to my door and I would have it there waiting for me. Hmm. So I didn't have to go search for the news online all day. I didn't have to worry I was going to miss something. I knew that, you know, it's going to be there in the morning and I can open up the newspaper and I can digest what's important for the day every day. It's going to be there. I don't have to worry about missing something. The second thing it did, and I think this is really what got me, is that, you know, I missed the idea of flipping that last page of the paper. The internet has no last page.
Right.
The internet never says, you're done. You know enough for the day. But that satisfaction of flipping that last page of the newspaper and saying, okay, I have read the day's paper. I am informed. Let me carry on with my day and not have to feel like I need to go find more and more information all the time.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And I'm interested in if listeners are feeling some version of this, talking with Nir Eyal, talking about his news diet of sorts. He's a business consultant, wrote a book called Hooked, and he's the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, a lot to cover. And that's part of why we're talking to Nir Eyal, because there is just this onslaught of news. And I think a lot of people are feeling a bit overwhelmed and a bit stressed out. Again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Nir, you also got off Twitter and Facebook on your phone. And of course, our phone is in our pocket, in our pocketbook, easily accessible. It seems like you also limited your access to the news feeds, I guess, that can come in on that a device like that.
Right. So I want to start by saying I'm no Luddite. I love technology. I much prefer to live in a world with Twitter and with Facebook and with Instagram. I love these technologies. However, you know, like every good thing, too much of a good thing can be a bad thing. And so there were some pretty drastic steps that I took. I uninstalled Twitter from my phone. Now, I still use Twitter. I just found that checking it throughout the day really wasn't serving me. It was distracting me from work. It was coming in the way of sitting down and having a meal with someone I wanted to talk with. So I just uninstalled the Twitter app for my phone, and now I only check it on my desktop. I did the same thing with Facebook. I don't use Facebook on my phone anymore. And by the way, you know, I live in the heart of Silicon Valley, and I love these technologies. I just think it's important to put them in the right places at the right times. Another thing I did that I recommend, that I'm a big fan of, is I installed a Chrome extension so that my browser, now every time I go online and look at Facebook, I install a Chrome extension called Facebook Newsfeed Eradicator, and it does exactly what it says. It literally will scrub the newsfeed from Facebook and just replace it with a nice inspirational quote. And the reason I did that was because, you know, I like Facebook. I think it does do a lot of good for me, and I particularly like to go to see a friend's page and see what's going on in their life. What I don't like is this, you know, slot machine-like newsfeed that just goes on and on and on, and frankly is algorithmically made to suck you in. I mean, I teach companies how to do this, so I know what's going on. And so I at one point figured that, you know what, this really isn't serving me. So I installed this newsfeed eradicator.
So are you as informed as you think you should be and feeling less stress? Has this worked?
I think I am, actually. And in fact, I think I'm less reactionary and more reflective, meaning that, you know, I think some of the things that we miss by just jumping headline to headline to headline is the analysis. And by consuming news, I still consume the news. I still want to know what's going on in today's events. But by saying, look, I'm going to consume the news 1 hour. I do it in the evening before I go to bed. I take out the newspaper and I just get to it at the end of the day. Yeah. And I know it's going to be there. There's no rush. There's no urgency. And just by, you know, getting through the paper, seeing the big picture. By the way, I also subscribed to a paper that was at the slightly opposite end of my political spectrum. So I wanted something that gave me a contrary opinion, just so I can, you know, I knew that my opinion was going to get to me. So I instead wanted to subscribe to a paper that was slightly opposite to my political spectrum.
Do you watch cable TV, news TV?
I don't at all. And I frankly, it's hard for me to see why that's so valuable, because if you think about the nature of cable news, it's nothing but headlines. It's nothing but sound bites. doesn't have the kind of, I think, thoughtful reflectiveness that you might find in the editorial page of a newspaper or even a good television show. You know, if you think about a Frontline or a 60 Minutes, something that somebody has taken a lot of time to think through to kind of give you the full story.
This is unique to the world that we're living in now, but there is a kind of concern that the information that we're getting is not trustworthy. I mean, as someone who has a radio show, we do our best to bring people things that have been vetted. But there is this whole thing now about alternative facts and fake news. Do you think that adds to people's stress, feeling as if, am I getting information that is correct or incorrect?
Right. Well, I think there's probably a few different kinds of fake news. So there's the brand new kind that we've heard about in the headlines, where someone is crafting a story to garner clicks online. I mean, this is the big story of people starting businesses with clearly fake headlines called clickbait,
right,
which are meant to just make you click on them, get to a website so that they can make money on your impression. And they have no regard for any kind of facts. Now, that's the new kind of fake news, which, by the way, are pretty much screened out if you do something like what I do and don't check your news feed on Facebook for news. Go get your news from other sources. But then there's the old kind of fake news, which has been around forever, which, you know, a lot of people think journalists lie. Well, of course journalists lie. That's because people lie to them all the time. People are only as good as journalists are only as good as their sources. And so, of course, you're going to get people lying to journalists because they have different agendas around what they'd like to get the journalists to write about. And that's where I think we need to slow it down a little bit. I think when it comes to a slower news type diet, we can screen out some of that stuff. We give time for other journalists, for the marketplace of ideas, to sort out what's real and what's not. Whereas if we try and constantly stay updated, we can be persuaded by stuff that hasn't been vetted. And by the way, I think one of the most important things, back to this question of is it serving me or am I serving it, is to ask ourselves, you know, what do I gain by being so up to date? Why does it matter that I know about this executive order the minute it happens? Hmm. Why does breaking news really matter to me? It doesn't. I mean, unless you're in government somewhere and it's part of your job function, it can wait a day. It can wait a week. There's nothing that urgent that you need to know the minute it happens for the vast majority of news. And frankly, if something is so catastrophic that you need to know about it this second, that information is going to find you.
We found you because you were quoted in an article in the New York Times. I'm curious about what response you've gotten to your what we've been talking about during this segment of the show.
Oh, it's been really good, actually. I think the most common response is wow, I feel that too, and I feel that stress. I mean, for me, you know, around the elections, it was almost a physical reaction just from the exhaustion of constantly trying to keep updated with what's happening. That I kind of lost myself. It felt like a binge of sorts that I had to wake up from and ask myself, is this really good for me? And based on the comments I've gotten and the feedback so far, it seems like a lot of other people felt that stress as well.
And do you think satire, parody, comedy, humor, do you think that's a good sort of antidote to the kind of news stress that I think a lot of people are feeling?
Well, I think there's probably a lot of antidotes. I think, you know, part of the problem, you know, I study habits, I study addiction. And one of the classic symptoms of an addiction and what makes it different from just any other behavior is that these addictions are behaviors that look like the solution, but then become the problem. So I want to drink to take the edge off, but then, of course, the more I drink, the worse my life becomes. I cause problems in my family, and it becomes a self-reinforcing downward spiral. And I think to some extent, news has that same property that we think we're consuming the news to help us be informed, to make us less stressed about missing any important information. But then, of course, the more we consume it, if we do it to an extreme extent, we become more stressed, right? We become more worried. And that, of course, leads us to consume more news to try and alleviate that stress.
Well, Nir Eyal, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. He's a business consultant, wrote a book called Hooked, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about the program. Download a podcast. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter, although not every minute, I guess, based on my conversation I just had. I'm Marty Moscone. Thanks for joining us.